Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the African American Studies Program at Boston University titled The Great Migration, The Untold Story of the 20th Century. Our speaker is Pulitzer Prize winner and Boston University Professor of Journalism, Isabel Wilkerson. We begin with an introduction by Dr. Allison Blakely, Boston University Professor of European Comparative History in the African American Studies Program.
Isabel Wilkerson, as Chicago bureau chief of the New York Times, won the 1994 Pulitzer Prize for feature writing for her coverage of the historic floods in the Midwest and for her profile of a 10-year-old boy growing up with a man's obligations on the South Side of Chicago. This award made her the first black woman to win a Pulitzer Prize in journalism and the first black American to win for individual reporting in the history of the prizes. She also won the George Polk Award for her coverage of the Midwest and was named Journalist of the Year by the National Association of Black Journalists. Wilkerson spent most of her journalism career at The Times, and her work has been widely anthologized. She's come to be known for nonfiction narratives that combine the disciplines of journalism and ethnography. She's written extensively on issues of social policy and the human condition, as well as on major stories of the day, such as the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and the challenges of upward mobility for the Times 2005 series and book, Class in America. She's lectured on narrative nonfiction at universities, at newspapers, and at professional writing workshops throughout the country, in Canada and in Denmark, and has conducted narrative writing seminars at the Naiman Foundation at Harvard University. At the university level, she served as the James M. Cox Professor at Emory University, as Ferris Professor of Journalism at Princeton University, and as the Krieger-Wolf Endowed Lecturer at Northwestern University. She's also served as a board member of the National Arts in Journalism program at Columbia University. The John Simon Guggenheim Foundation awarded her a fellowship to advance the research for her book, The Great Migration, on which she will speak today. The book is a work of narrative nonfiction about the migration of African Americans from the rural and small town South to the urban North and West during most of the 20th century. Professor Wilkerson.
What I'm going to be talking about today is in some ways the process of working on this book. I'm very excited about some of the things I have to show you and talk with you about. First, I wanted to just pass around the cover. And because it's such a small, intimate group, I want it to be interactive because I'd like to know what you all think. I'd like your opinion about it. So this is the cover for the book. You can see it here, and I'm going to pass it around. And it gives you a sense of what the book is about. I think it's beautiful. Love the cover. People look at the photograph and just find it breathtaking. I can't wait to get a poster of it. It is a vintage photograph from the WPA from the 1940s. The title of the book is The Warmth of Other Suns. There's a story behind that as well. So it's just a pleasure to be able to talk with you about it. The cover shows essentially a gorgeous tenement with ornate fretwork in the front, which we believe is from 7th Avenue in Harlem. And on the cover, the photograph has its vignettes. Every window has people looking out, kind of like the movie Rear Window, where you had tenement scenes and windows, and you could sort of imagine. And so you see that everyone who was inside the building, who was living in the building, came out for this photograph. And it's amazing to get cooperation of this many people. There must be 100 people in the photograph. And each window tells a story as people are, and there are soldiers in there. They're mostly African Americans. If you can look closely, you'll see three white people, which is quite interesting and lovely. So it's just an interesting, you could just look at it for hours. And the thing about it is that very much like human behavior, there's always someone, you'll notice that there's one window where the people just said, nope, we're not cooperating. In any case, I come to you today after, in some ways, emerging from a cave, the cave that a writer must go into in order to come out with this kind of work. The book weaves together the stories of three families that migrated from the South to the North and the West during different decades of the 20th century. So essentially, it's a story of a century. And it took 15 years to research, report, distill, and write, and now edit and get it to this point. So it's been a 15-year process, 15 years. So I wanted to talk a little bit today about why I decided to do it, what that process was like. First of all, why I decided to do it and how I decided to do it. As was mentioned in the bio, I was a reporter and I was a Chicago bureau chief for the New York Times for about a correspondent and then Chicago bureau chief total time was about 8 or 9 years. And in the mid-90s, there were some big stories that occurred and then there was a big story that I wrote that won the Pulitzer Prize. And after you win a Pulitzer Prize, I think that depending upon where you are in your career, you face a lot of questions as to what you will do next. There's some people who choose to go into an editing track. That's a very natural thing because you're kind of, in some ways, a leader, so to speak, in the newsroom. Other people decide that they want to write columns and have a voice, express themselves that way. Some people actually kind of go off the deep end, it turns out. There are some people who get what they call like a Jesus complex, and they they have a hard time coming down from the high, because you're just a normal person. It's just one thing that has happened to you that's an achievement, and you're happy and wonderful to have gotten to that point. But it doesn't mean suddenly that you can cut the line at Starbucks or that everyone's supposed to bow down to you when you come into the newsroom. And there's some people who expect that, so some people have a difficult time adjusting. And many people go on to write books. Many people do that. So I had to figure out what was I going to do. And many people will continue doing what got them to that position. They stay in the position and continue to do the same work. And everybody has a different way of dealing with that. For me, I decided that I wanted to figure out what could I do that would be meaningful, would be able to make a difference somehow. I'd been covering the cities that also, if you're in Chicago, the Chicago Bureau covers 12 states in the Midwest. And so therefore you do a lot of rural coverage. We write about the depopulation of the rural states. There was a huge flood, a 500-year flood that occurred, which is also the reason why one of the stories that I wrote that won the Pulitzer Prize, there were three stories that won. And I decided that I perhaps had made good progress in doing that, and I just thought I would want to do something that might be different, and maybe give greater insight beyond what you can do in a couple of days or in a couple of weeks in a story of 4,000 words or so, which is a really long story in a newspaper. The New York Times was wonderful and generous in allowing me that kind of space. But I just thought maybe there's maybe even more that could be done, and I wanted to try my hand at that. So what I decided to do was I decided that what would be the topic that would allow me to build on what I had done covering the cities, give insight into what a lot of these things meant. You were talking about the so many things, the rise of a black middle class. At the same time, you had what was then called the underclass. You had there were drugs in the cities. There was hyper-segregation, all these different terms that were popular in the 1990s to sort of figure out what was it that was going on in the cities. How had the cities been affected by this influx of people from all over the world and also from the South? And so I decided that I would write about something that I had grown up with, but that I and that really most other Americans really take for granted, partly because we just don't think about it. We just know very little about it. We think we do because we've heard the term the Great Migration, but there's so much more to it. And in my view, I found enough to write 700 pages, which is 200,000 words. Anyway, I decided to write about the Great Migration, which was the outpouring of African Americans out of the South from World War I, which is one of the questions I get. What are the years of this Great Migration? From World War I to the 1970s. And there are a lot of people who think of one aspect of the Great Migration, say the World War I migration, which was actually formally called the Great Migration. And then some people think about the World War II influx of people, which actually was so much larger that the original World War I migration was dwarfed by the much larger World War II migration. And then it turned out that if you look at the numbers, it didn't end until the 1970s. So what you had was one long, continuous, unending influx of people from the South to the North until the 1970s, when the primary reasons for their initial departures had been essentially maybe not resolved, but were beginning to be addressed. And so that's why I describe the migration as one long 60 or 70 year period of time cannot be contained by a demographer's choice of a year, because that's not how human beings think and act, really. I mean, nobody told the people in 1942 that, well, you know, actually the Great Migration ended in 1919, and therefore you shouldn't be coming up here. I mean, nobody told them that, so they kept coming. And it ended up being, because it was so vast and went on for so long, and it fell outside the general parameters of what we would consider daily journalism, because it actually spanned many generations of journalists. I mean, there were journalists who started writing about the first wave of migration, among them Carl Sandburg. Carl Sandburg, the poet, wrote a book called The Chicago Riots. And he was a reporter at the Chicago Daily News. And he wrote about the essentially the Great Migration as it was occurring in Chicago, the original one. So by the time this migration ended, look at how his career and in his life had changed. He was no longer even known as a reporter, but was, you know, one of the most famous poets of the 20th century. And so this migration went on for so long that it was really difficult for daily journalism to capture it and to figure out what does it mean. And that's why it could be viewed as one of the greatest underreported stories of the 20th century, simply because it was too large to be contained within the parameters of daily journalism. And that means that it primarily was the purview first of sociologists and economists. Many of the first studies of the migration occurred in Chicago, which is why we often think of Chicago for the migration, because the University of Chicago, the Chicago School, the emerging philosophy of looking at human populations in the way that the University of Chicago was developing at that time. This was a perfect laboratory. The arrival of Southerners, Southern farm people, rural people, small town people from the South, African Americans arriving in large numbers at the 12th Street Station in Chicago and finding their way to what ultimately came to be called Bronzeville, which was the mid-South Side section of Chicago. That influx of people was the perfect, in some ways, laboratory for trying to understand what happens in a community when you have this large a group of people coming in all at once. And So that it was a purview of sociologists and of economists who looked at the effects on the city, effects on housing, the tenements. They would go in and study it in that way. But oddly enough, there was very little focus on the people themselves. Very little. Most of it was about the influx and the impact of the influx, but not about the people themselves. And where there were references to the people themselves, they were often just a single reference, a single quote from someone about why they left or where they came from. And it ended up being that the people kind of got lost to history as a result of that. And so one of the goals that I set out to do was to try to find the remaining people from the earliest wave that I could, in order to capture those stories before it was too late, because you can do the math yourself and see that if someone was leaving North Carolina for Washington, D.C., or for New York City, or for Boston, they, in, say, 1929, they would be quite up in years now. And so there was this effort. I mean, there was this real focus on my part to try to capture the stories before it was too late. But at the same time, I had no idea clearly that it was going to take this long. I mean, there is no way I would have thought that it would take this long. I had a general idea that it was going to take a while, a year or so probably, to find people. But I had no idea that this whole thing would take 15 years. Had I been aware that it was going to take 15 years to do this, there would be no book. There absolutely would be no book. There's no way in the world I would have taken this on for 15 years. I mean, it's a good thing I didn't know, actually, that it was going to take this long. So I wanted to give you a little sense of, I actually have learned to embrace what is, and I embrace the fact that it took that long, and there are many good things about the fact that it took that long. But before I talk about the good things about why it took that long, I want to put in perspective what did not exist when I started the book. When I started the book, Google did not exist. That means I couldn't Google anything. I mean, I didn't even know that no one knew there was a Google, so I didn't miss it because there was no Google. There were no DVDs. This was before iPods, Blackberries, which I have now, MP3 players. No text messaging existed at the time, things that we just take for granted. Actually, to tell you the truth, email was still quite new. There were no Kindles, of course, because Kindles didn't come out in 2007. Babies that were born when I started the book are now in high school. 2 Shakur was alive and Facebook did not exist. You know, of course, Twitter didn't exist. So all these things did not exist at the time I started the book. But it also is representative of the fact that things that I really needed in order to tell the story fully also did not exist. For example, in the time that when I began the work, such things as JSTOR were not commonly available. In the course of working on the book, many of the newspapers that were not available, you have to go through the flapping of the microfilm experience, you know, that lovely feeling of being in the dark cave, of it getting off track, flapping, of you have to, you know, you get so, your mind goes numb, you stop seeing what you're looking for. I'm saying, thank you for appreciating what I'm going through. And then you just say, I'm going to go fast through this. And then you realize that you've passed the year that you needed. So you have to go back. There's no shortcut with microfilm, right? So that was what I started out doing. I mean, it was in order to find things. And suddenly, about within the last 5 years, I could call up the Chicago Defender any day that I needed for the Chicago Defender, just do a search, which is shocking. I mean, unbelievable. I mean, this changes the whole face of the way we do research now. So much easier. You get so spoiled now. And I can't imagine having finished the book with the level of depth and a feeling of completion that I actually have reached the things that I needed to find, found the things I needed to find without having access to that. I mean, it's really a beautiful thing. Not only that, JSTOR has made almost any scholarly work. And of course, much of the work on the Great Migration was scholarly. I mean, we're going back to, I actually was able to find, with not very much difficulty, it's just a matter of identifying it. Identifying it took longer than getting it or retrieving it, a seminal article about human migration in general. It's the seminal article about human migration, which should be an inspiration to all of us doing research right now. This seminal article about human migration stands to this day. It has never been surpassed, and it was written in 1883 by Professor E.G. Ravenstein, and he presented the paper in 1883 to the, I believe it was the Royal Historical Society of Great Britain, the laws of what make people move from one place to another. And that was the kind of thing I wanted to understand as to why people made this decision to leave the only place they'd ever known for a place they'd never seen. Because this migration was not unlike most other migrations. We think of it as different because it occurred within the borders of the United States, because these were African Americans, already Americans, who were moving from one place within the country to another. We also think of it as being perhaps its own thing because of the unique history of African Americans in this country. But at the core of it was just the human yearning of one individual or a family or the head of the family or the mother. Sometimes the mother was the one saying, we're leaving. I'm not staying here one more day. We're leaving. Of the human yearning of an individual who wanted to leave one place where they felt things were either untenable, there was little hope, there was no opportunity for betterment, or worse, things were worse than even that, and they decided there must be someplace better. And that's why the title of the book is The Warmth of Other Suns, because there were other suns that these people sought to find in order to be their fuller selves. And so the fact that it took so long actually was a blessing, because it allowed it allowed me to be able to find the material that I needed in order to shape and understand the context in which the people made their decision to leave with a greater authority, because I had more things to draw upon than just the stories of the people that I had interviewed. Because the stories of the people that I interviewed, of course, are priceless, because there's no value you can put on an individual human story, a person who's sitting in front of you who's lived this thing. But you also need to have that support that comes from all of the research that had gone before. There was no reason for me to have to reinvent the wheel. I mean, much of that research had been done. It was just a matter of finding the wheel. And so all of this technology helped me to find the wheel more easily. I want to say, though, that aspirin and cable television did, however, exist at the time I started. I just had that as a note that I wanted to make sure you knew that. So, not knowing what I was getting into, I set out to find people who had left the South over the course of the 20th century. And I'm going to throw it to the audience where you think I went to find these people, because this is going to be interactive. As I tell them, not to suggest that this is a class, because this is so totally different, but there's an opportunity for engagement. Alabama, Georgia area. Yeah, those are the states. Those are states.
Carolinas.
The whole South, really. I mean, the South is large. Now, that is correct. The answer is correct, but there's a twist to the answer. And that is that I actually did not go directly to those places. I actually went to the North, because that's where the people who had left were. So that's what I ended up doing. Yeah. So I ended up going to where the people had gone, because the people had gone. So I went to, I did a lot of traveling, which is one reason why this took time. I spent a lot of time in Los Angeles. I spent a lot of time in New York. I spent a lot of time in Chicago, where I was living at the time. And I would go into senior centers. I would go into, I would go to churches. I would go to, there were AARP meetings on the South Side. People don't realize that there are AARP meetings on the South Side of Chicago. You know, those, I went to every kind of retirees union local thing, you know, like the retired postal workers, the retired CTA workers. I mean, I was all those. In fact, I went to so many of these places, I would run into the same people. Some people from the CTA might have been at the church that I went to on Sunday. You know, I mean, there's this, you run into the same crowd of very active seniors, and it was actually kind of nice. Same thing happened in LA too. In fact, at one place, one person I found actually said, you know, I've seen you at these different places asking these questions of the seniors, and you know, I notice I can hear what you're asking, you know, and I think I know a person who would be perfect for you. And whenever someone says that, you think, no, it's not, that's never going to happen. It's almost like someone saying, I know the, you know, a blind, setting up a blind date, you know, that's not going to work, and you hate the person. Or people who often say to you, you know, you look just like, and you never look like that. You're just like, where in the world did you get the idea that I look like this person? What must you think I look like? But this person, she actually had been paying close attention to what I had asked, because she ended up identifying for me. The person she recommended, even though I didn't get to her. In fact, I took my time. I just said, well, you know, it's nice to know that she's taken the time to give me a name, and I'll get to it. You know, I'll get to it when I get to it. Meanwhile, I went to all these other places, and he was unbelievable. He was one of the three people that I ended up with. One of the three. But I'm ahead of myself a little bit. There were so many challenges to reaching people. So many challenges, because you never realize what you're coming into when you're going into a room of all strangers. I mean, remember, this was journalism, a kind of ethnography, because there was an effort to go beyond just asking a person a question, but really trying to understand their experience and trying to understand what their lives were like back where they came from and how that had translated into a new life in this new world. And my goal was not merely to just go and ask a person a question, but to really understand where they had come from. And so what I would do is I would go into these places, and there would be hundreds and hundreds of people, and I would, you know, begin to speak with them. And each place was a little different depending upon how it was set up. It ultimately meant that I ended up interviewing over 1,500 people for the book. 1,500 people. And I stopped counting after that because it went on for a good amount of time. It was 18 months to 2 years of just looking for people. And it took time because you'd have to set things up. You don't just show up someplace. You don't just show up at a senior center where no one's expecting you and start talking to people. So it took a lot of time to set that up. So these were some of the challenges that I ran into. First of all, the very first summer that I was working on it, even though the people were from the South and would have been hardy when it comes to heat, they had been living in the North long enough that they had grown to become accustomed to the cold. And so the very first summer, that summer, was a record heat wave. This is when I first started work. I mean, just out of the gate, had the lead from the New York Times, ready to go. Record heat wave, never recorded before or since. Seniors were getting sick, reported in the paper, headlines in Chicago. It was like a major disaster of people who didn't have air conditioning and died. I mean, just there went, you know, there was another person from the Great Migration gone. And it was happening over and over and over again, and it was adding to a sense of panic for everyone. I mean, the whole city was upset with just all kinds of horror, you know, very sad stories of that. But for me, it had great resonance because I was feeling almost like I needed to talk with everyone. Of course, you can't talk with everyone, but I had this feeling that I wanted to. Another thing is that I was told, you know, people, there are always people whenever you're starting. I'm hoping, always thinking that there can be a lesson to be learned in situations like this. And whenever you start something, I don't care what it is, there's always someone who will say, I don't think you'll ever be able to, you know, fill in the blank. I don't see how you ever will be able to. And so I was telling some people at one event that as I was just beginning, and why would someone say that when you're just beginning? You don't even know what you're going to be doing, and you're just, you know, you're just trying to get yourself fired up and revved up for it. And someone will come in and say this. So I was telling someone, you know, well, I would, you know, it began in World War I, and it would be really good to get someone from World War I. Now remember, this is the '90s, so theoretically, there are people who live to be 100, and so the person, and I said, so I really will be, I'll be looking at that. I'll be looking for that. I didn't really know for sure, but I said I would, and the person said, well, you'll never find anybody from World War I. I mean, you could just forget that. World War I, I mean, there's no way in the world you're going to find anyone from World War I. So, of course, that meant I was determined to find somebody from World War I. It's not as if the book would rise or fall on the strength of having found someone, but just saying that I couldn't meant that I was going to make sure I would at least try. And just because I wanted to see I could cover the gamut, because that was what I had set out to do. And believe it or not, I found, although he did not end up being a major character in the book, but I felt vindicated. I felt like I had covered the bases that I had been exposed to. And all, you know, you learn that in the course of research, even the things that you don't end up using directly can have can give you the authority and the confidence to move forward in whatever your thesis or whatever your continuing effort might be. And so that's what this did. But I actually found someone who had been born in 1896. This was 1996, and he had been a soldier in war, an infantryman in World War I, and he had come up from Mississippi to Chicago. And one of my requirements was that it could not be children. People who had come up as children. I was not looking for people who were, you know, riding in their mother's lap up to the new world. I wanted someone who had made the decision, because the effort is to try to understand why would people do this. You can't, and someone who was 5 at the time, even though they might be 75 now, would not be able to tell you truly why or how the decision had been made. They could tell you what they were told, but they were not part of the decision-making process. And so he actually was old enough. He'd actually come up in like in the early 20s as a grown man, and had made the decision. And I interviewed him quite a bit. And actually, when you do this kind of thing, it's ethnography. You get to know them well, and fairly well. And I actually said, well, you know, his birthday was coming up. I actually found, do you know that there are birthday cards for 100-year-olds? They're hard to find, but you can find birthday cards for people who turn 100, and I found a birthday card for him. So that was one of the things I had to overcome. Again, it doesn't make it in the book, but it felt good to be able to find him. Then I ran into the fact that I was having to, there are people who are suspicious of people who come around, you know, asking questions about this. Not everybody wants to necessarily talk about these things for many kinds of reasons. It may not be because there's anything necessarily bad. They just are not accustomed to people coming in and interviewing them. Ethnography is extremely in-depth, and it requires participant observation, spending time with them, lots and lots of time. And some people were not especially interested in that kind of commitment. And so there was that thing that I had to overcome. But there were some nuances to that that you couldn't have expected going in. And one of them had to do with the fact that some of the people you might run into had spouses. And those spouses weren't particular about having younger woman. I mean, they're in their 80s, so most... Many people would be younger women, and they're old enough to be my grandparents at the time, and some of the wives, you know, were not especially excited about my wanting to interview their husbands. Sometimes they'll say the wife had been born in the north and the husband had been born in the south, so I'm not interested in the wife. I mean, I'm sorry, I'll talk with you, but you're not. That's not the story I'm trying to tell here. So it just so happened I was more interested in your 83-year-old husband, but not in the way you might think. I mean, I wasn't interested in him the way she might have been fearful I would be. And so I would call up the house, I'd get the number, and I'd ask to speak with Mr. Johnson or whoever it was. And she would say, well, who's calling? And I'd say who it was. He's not here. And I can hear the background. Who is that calling? Who's out on the phone? So, you know, what you learn from a researcher perspective when you're doing this kind of thing is that while you could press forward, it's not worth pressing forward if there's going to be that kind of an issue. So that was yet another challenge that I faced. And then the most interesting, probably the toughest single moment when it came to being out there looking for people came from one of the Los Angeles senior centers that I went to. Set it all up to go in there and talk with the seniors on a particular day. I'd been told that this was a really good day because the seniors had were going to be it was steak day or something. It was steak lunch, and so a lot of people would be there, so you'd have a good turnout. There might have been bingo going on at the same time. It was going to be a really good day to interview seniors. Lots of people would be there. They were expecting me. They even had me on the schedule to make my presentation. So all looked to be well. So I'm sitting where I'm told to sit, waiting to make my presentation. And just before I go up to speak to the seniors, there's an official from L.A. County. L.A. County senior extension or Department of Aging was coming up to make an important announcement to the seniors gathered. He'd been going from senior center to make this important announcement. And the announcement was this. The announcement was that we are getting reports of abuse of seniors and swindling of seniors by people who will be strangers to you, who will come and ask you all kinds of intimate questions, all kinds of questions about where you are from, how long you've lived in your home, what kind of work you did, about your children. They'll be asking you all kinds of questions. And what they're trying to do is get information about you so that they can get access to your bank accounts and to your other accounts, Social Security, and they're taking the seniors, you know, retirement, taking all of the life savings of some of our seniors. So I'm here to just warn you to please, if anyone comes up to you that you do not know, asking you questions about your life, do not talk to these people. Do not talk with them. Next, will Miss Wilkerson please come up to speak? She's next on the agenda is Miss Wilkerson, and she says she's writing a book for Random House. And I go up there, and what do I want? I want to know everything. Absolutely everything. And so I go along with my spiel. What can you do? I mean, I've flown all the way from Chicago. I mean, I had to do what I had to do. And I say to the people, I say, well, I'm writing a book about the Great Migration, about the migration of people. When you're in Los Angeles, they have people from Louisiana and Texas to California from World War I to the 1970s. And if you participated in this, I would love to be able to talk with you about it, talk about your experiences, trying to emphasize Great Migration, don't need to know bank account and that sort of thing. Didn't say it, but, you know, just want to emphasize it. And the beautiful thing is the people hadn't paid attention to what the man said, which is the problem. I mean, that's why they were being swindled. They didn't pay attention to it. I had a great time. Everybody crowded around me and they started telling me their stories. It was wonderful. But who knew? You know, who knew? And so those were some of the many barriers that I ran into that I could not have anticipated in the process of all of this. Now, what is the Great Migration and why is it important? The Great Migration is essentially the story of almost every African American in the North and West, ultimately. It is the story of the ancestors, the parents, the grandparents, the aunts, the uncles, great aunts, great uncles, cousins, second cousins, half-siblings of most African Americans in the North and West. That's huge. That is absolutely mind-blowing if you think about it. That is how the majority of African Americans got to Chicago, Detroit, New York, Los Angeles, Oakland, Seattle, Washington, D.C., Cleveland, St. Louis, Boston, Philadelphia. That is how African Americans got to ended up creating in some ways by default neighborhoods that are recognizable in almost any of these cities. If you're from any of these cities, you know exactly where that community is because that's where the first people who were part of the Great Migration landed when they first came in from the South. That's huge. It changed the face of every city in the North and the West. And one of the reasons that I wanted to do it is I wanted to, while Chicago was extremely important in the migration, a lot of the focus has been on Chicago, again, as I said earlier, because of the fact that the Chicago School was there. There were people already there ready and primed to be able to do the kind of work that was necessary in order to record this demographic shift, and they were there to capture certainly the scholarly perspective on this migration. And there weren't necessarily the same people in place in Cleveland and in Detroit and in Philadelphia. There were actually some seminal works done out of Philadelphia and out of Pittsburgh, but the ongoing coverage of it ended up being kind of dominated by Chicago, and that's why a lot of people focus on Chicago. Chicago's huge in the understanding of the Great Migration, but it's just one city. All of the cities in the North and the West were affected by this. Changed forever by this. That's one aspect of the migration. Another thing is that the Great Migration changed popular culture in ways that we still are trying to learn about and appreciate and untangle, you might say. The works of almost every major novelist of the 20th century were affected by the Great Migration. Richard Wright, his entire career essentially was trying to understand the Great Migration because he'd been part of it. The works of Toni Morrison and August Wilson and Ralph Ellison and A Raisin in the Sun, Lorraine Hansberry, all of these are essentially stories of the Great Migration. They don't come out and say it. They may not even use the term Great Migration, but that's what they are. The works of each of those people were essentially the work of artists trying to make sense of what had gone before them to create the world that they grew up in. Because all of these people, most of these people were products of the Great Migration. Toni Morrison was a product of the Great Migration, her parents having migrated from Alabama to Lorain, Ohio. Obviously, Richard Wright was himself, he migrated in 1927 from Chicago, Mississippi, Natchez, Mississippi, to Memphis, and then on to Chicago, and spent his entire career, everything he wrote was about the migration, essentially, everything. And so that's one aspect in terms of literature. But then music, I mean, music, we could go on and on. Music is probably the single most... what is the aspect of culture that was affected most dramatically by the arrival of people. And most people think about the blues, which is critical. But that's just the beginning. Jazz would not be what it is, absolutely not, without the Great Migration. The three pillars of jazz were all from the South: Thelonious Monk, Coltrane, and also Miles Davis were all either migrants themselves or they were descended from people who migrated from the South. And then you get into Motown, which is a story unto itself and which is self-explanatory, actually, because Berry Gordy was himself a child of the migration, his parents having come from Georgia, and he ended up growing up in Detroit, and he drew from the children around him, the young people around him, who themselves were all children of the migration. Diana Ross, Aretha Franklin, all of those people who Aretha Franklin was not directly with Motown, but Diana Ross and the Supremes, all of them were children of people who come up essentially from some of the same states. That's another thing about the migration, which also harkens back to the Ravenstein work, in which these migrations were orderly, thought out, predictable. They were not willy-nilly, just randomly, I just think I'll just up and go to Detroit. If you were in a particular southern state, it could almost be predicted where you would end up. Not because they were drones, but because the road had already been paved, the rail lines were all leading in one direction. They went the most direct route out of the South, and they followed the path of those who'd gone before them, and it multiplied until you had such a critical mass that you have entire sections of cities that are essentially in some ways transplantations of southern states. Those migration routes were from Alabama and Georgia to Detroit and Cleveland, for example, going straight north, from Mississippi and Arkansas to Chicago, from Louisiana and Texas out to California, we're out to Los Angeles and to Oakland, and then beyond that to Seattle. All very orderly, predictable, in the same way that any immigrant group from any part of Europe or parts of Central or South America or from Asia, where people end up in particular places for a reason. There's a reason that, a good proportion, I read somewhere that 25%, at one particular year, 25% of all the people in the state of Minnesota were Swedes or Norwegians. There's a reason for that. And it's a beautiful symmetry. It's a beautiful predictability about human nature, which also played out in the migration, because essentially this was an immigrant experience, not an immigrant experience in that they were not from this country, but that they were leaving in the same way that any immigrant would ever leave the only place they'd ever known for a place they'd never seen, for a life that they hoped would be better than where they had before. And that's the enduring, unifying effect of all of this. And in some ways, it could be said that's one of the tragedies of the politics of the cities that the people went to, because they often were pitted against people who were very much like them. They were pitted against the Italians and the Poles and the Hungarians, who all were coming from the same small, rural settings. Really didn't, essentially finding themselves hurled into the middle of a big roiling city that they didn't understand, working with machinery as opposed to the land, trying to make a way for themselves, not really speaking the language. Some people say that Southern English is not the same thing as Northern English, and people couldn't understand them. And all of those, the cultural, socioeconomic class divisions that they found in the North of being outsiders, all of these groups were outsiders, and they had so much more in common among themselves than anyone ever really sat down and thought about. And that's one of the great tragedies of the 20th century, I believe. One of the great tragedies of the 20th century is that people who had so much in common were divided once they got to these big cities. And they had done the exact same thing. There is no difference. It's just that some people had come from, southern Italy, and other people had come from South Carolina. But the same reason, Same kind of people, same hard working people who were often taken advantage of by industrialists who pitted one against the other. While some were unionized and were on strike for better living conditions, they would bring in the African American migrants who had been used to nothing. I mean, not even being paid, because some might have been sharecroppers. And even if they weren't sharecroppers, they were still woefully underpaid because there was a caste system that kept them from being paid what they might have been due. And they were used to working long hours. And that was a tremendous use of leverage by industrialists. And it also served to pit one group against the other. And I am convinced that's one of the greatest tragedies of the 20th century. It's really, truly sad. And it's my hope that people can see the commonalities in the stories of the people in this book and see that in a way all of us have an immigrant past, not an immigrant in that we all necessarily come from a place that's foreign and alien and therefore not deserving. What I mean is this desire, America is built on the idea that people who come from another place can come here and be and live out to be their true full selves, that they couldn't be wherever they were before. And that's why the country is a great country, and it is my hope that people will be able to see that that's exactly what people were doing in the Great Migration. Exact same thing. Hardworking people. There's so much in the book that there's not enough time to talk about, but I was just stunned by the numbers that I discovered about, the number of hours that African Americans worked vis-a-vis immigrants. I mean, they were all working long, long hours. They all worked in the slaughterhouses. The work and the hard work that these people had to experience was exactly the same. They were living the same lives and then torn apart. It's just really sad. But one of the things I wanted to do was to share with you, because we are, obviously a place where we celebrate research and discovery and the joys of discovery. So I wanted to share with you one of the joys of discovery in the process of working on this. For the longest time, I had no title. And for those of you who may have worked on books or you've worked on papers, you have to think of the title helps to guide you as to what it is. And so I was writing the entire time, researching the entire time without a guide, because I had no title. People would ask what the title was, and I had a couple ideas. And every time I'd say it, whatever the title was, I would say it tentatively, or I don't talk about the title. I had plenty of them, but I just never felt comfortable with it. And so in the process of doing the research and reading about the migration, I read, there'd be a point where I would be reading a book a day, because there are just so many scholarly works to be read and there's so much in them that you wanted to absorb. But part of it meant also reading literature of the era. And I read a version of Richard Wright's autobiography, which was called Black Boy. That was not the original title. The original title was American Hunger. It came out in 1945. What I had, though, was the full annotated version of the book. And in the annotated version, this new version is as he wished it to be, but it was not as it had been printed originally and had survived for essentially 50 years, until it was reprinted in 1993. And then it was the reprint in 1993 that restored to all of us what he originally wanted. And his original version of American Hunger was changed at the request of the Book of the Month Club. And they had issues and concerns with the second half of the book, which was about his time in the North. And they had, and that meant that his ending was not, he had to come up very quickly with another ending, that would be sufficient when you've lost half of your book. And he was willing to go forward with it because he wanted it published and he needed it published, and he did what was necessary in order to get it published. And so as I was reading the book, I decided to look carefully at the footnotes, because the notes were extensive about this. Actually, this paragraph was here. He wrote this to satisfy the needs of that in order to create a new ending. And so I read what the new ending passage was several pages of that, tiny type. And in it, I came across this obscure passage, and I realized how beautiful it was. I mean, I read the whole book, and the book has amazing anecdotes and stories about his experiences in the South and also in the North. But I was really taken by what was in the footnotes. And so in the footnotes, it's not in the main text, It's in small type on like page 437, and it summed up in a way everything that was in the hearts of these people who left, and in the hearts of anyone who's ever left the place, the only place they've ever known, for a place they've never seen, in hopes that whatever is waiting for them will be better than what they're leaving. And this is what he wrote. I was leaving the South to fling myself into the unknown. I was taking a part of the South to transplant in alien soil, to see if it could grow differently, if it could drink of new and cool rains, bend in strange winds, respond to the warmth of other suns, and perhaps to bloom. And that's just poetry. It's just beautiful. And it was in the footnotes, not even in the main text. And once I saw that, I knew that I wanted to include that clearly. But it also was the inspiration clearly of the title of the book, because it says so much, and it's beautiful that it's coming from the actual heart and voice of someone who actually did that. He was, in fact, the poet and the bard of the Great Migration. And he was so affected by it that he spent his entire career deconstructing it and trying to understand it and trying to get people to understand why it was so necessary for all of these people to do what they did. And so it was, you know, my pleasure to be able to discover that and to bring it out into the light again. And that's how the title came. Thank you so much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Pulitzer Prize winner and Boston University Professor of Journalism, Isabel Wilkerson. Professor Wilkerson's lecture was titled The Great Migration, The Untold Story of the 20th Century, and was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Professor Wilkerson was introduced by Dr. Allison Blakely, Boston University Professor of European Comparative History in the African American Studies Program. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Edward Mazulis. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.